the notion of like a traditional femininity, this is like having a big resurgence on TikTok and social media where women are like, actually, we want to be stay-at-home moms and actually we want to be housewives, you know. And this is our response to our difficult socioeconomic circumstances. And I get it, you know, like it is completely heartbreaking to work so very hard and to have it actually count for so very little.
Welcome to A Reader's Community. In today's episode, I talk to Lebohang Masango about the choices we make at the intersection of love and money. And Joy Watson tells me about some of her favorite anti-heroines. I'm your host, Feisty Carlitz. Lebohang Masango is the author of The Soft Life, a really interesting, nuanced, and open-ended exploration that emerges from conversations with five women who pursue the soft life. The soft life can be a life of luxury, of champagne and overseas travel, or it could just mean money being less of a perpetual worry. The book is about women who pursue this and see their dating lives as part of that pursuit. Lebohang is interested not just in the phenomenon of the pursuit of the soft life, but also in how it's perceived, how Black women are vilified for making choices that people make the world over. This book challenges moralizing discourses and speaks back to a context where Black women's sexuality is often medicalized in conversations about HIV or discussed in the context of sex work. Instead, this book centers women's choice, desire, and their pursuit of love. This book was fascinating, and I found my conversation with Lebohang just as interesting. I hope you enjoy it too. Welcome to A Reader's Community, Lebohang, and thank you for joining me on the podcast. I'd love to start with you introducing yourself and just telling me in a few sentences something about yourself.
Hi, Vasti. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast today. My name is Lebohang. I am what I call a stay-at-home anthropologist because I do all of my work from home. I also am a writer, an author, and a poet. And I've been published in a few anthropology publications, and I'm currently completing my PhD.
Amazing. And you're also a children's book author, right? That has been primarily what you've published before.
Yes, that is primarily what I've published before and what I enjoy publishing the most, yeah.
That's great. So today we're not talking about one of your children's books. We're talking about your recent nonfiction book called The Soft Life. This book was quite unlike anything I've read before. It's got some data in it. It's got a lot of theoretical insight. And the subject matter is something that I haven't read about in nonfiction texts in, I was going to say South Africa, but actually from anywhere. So could we start by you telling me a little bit about what The Soft Life is? What does it entail and how is it achieved?
So The Soft Life, what I always say is that it's what you make of it personally. For some people, the soft life is having an excess of disposable income and being able to spend it on consumer goods such as luxury brands, overseas trips, expensive champagne and experiences, going to the spa midweek, etc. For some people, that's what the soft life is. And because some other people's circumstances are a little bit more difficult than that, a soft life could be affording to have takeout at the end of the month when you get your paycheck, or just being able to send your children to that particular school and being able to afford their extramural activities. It looks different for all of us depending on where we sit on the scale of having and not having in South Africa.
At the beginning you quote, I think it's a song, right? Where this is a description of the soft life. And it says, I've opted out of strife. I'm taking everything in my stride. I will do the bare minimum. I won't be working hard. I mean, it sounds nice. I'm sure all of us want some version of this, to struggle a little bit less. So it is about a lifestyle, but it's also about, I mean, this book in particular is also about a certain strategy to get that lifestyle, right? And that strategy is via romance. Could you tell me about that strategy?
So for me, it was really important to highlight some of the creative ways that go into navigating socioeconomic precarity in South Africa. Mm. And a theory that has always resonated with me during my anthropology studies is the political economy of love and the way in which our intimate lives are affected by the grander superstructural happenings in our country and how those affect us, and how from the places of our intimate lives we have to then navigate and negotiate all of this. And so, yes, it is about romantic strategy, and it's also about the fact that with the surge of internet use in the country, with having access to different people's thoughts and belief systems and ways of moving through the world, it has been very influential for young women in South Africa, who many of them are deciding to be unapologetic in their realization that sometimes your relationship can either hinder you personally or it can help you to advance depending on the different choices that you make. And so it's important for me to have spoken to women who are career driven, who are ambitious, who are goal oriented and motivated in their own right, who already have achieved a soft life or are attempting to achieve it for their own selves, and then to speak about how the addition of a relationship brings them closer to that goal.
That's such a subtle way of framing it, which is also characteristic of your writing, which I really appreciate. But I think that something that comes through clearly in this question is challenging the distinction between intimate life as being apart from the economy, like you were saying now. Like, there's definitely a way in which our intimate lives interact with politics and with the economy. And also, I mean, especially romantic relationships, we have a long history of those being very closely tied to strategies for financial stability. There's a long history of this being women's best route to financial stability, sometimes only route. That's true across the world, but then in South Africa, we also have a history of Black women in particular being excluded from labor opportunities. And then again, romantic relationships become a more viable opportunity than work. So I think that there's this kind of idealized perception of romantic relationships, that they should have a purity, that they should be divorced from financial implications of those relationships. But that's, I mean, that's not how we approach romantic relationships. All of us take into account, maybe not, maybe I shouldn't say all of us. Let me nuance that. I'd say that it's very common, or it's true that most of us take financial implications into account when making romantic decisions. So could you elaborate a bit on that history that you lay out in the book, and then how that links to the present moment?
So, as a way of getting into that, I want to say that I appreciate your recognition of the fact that a lot of people have to use that as a consideration, because our current circumstances, especially when we say that Black women are excluded from labor opportunities, we also are sitting with a very big problem of youth unemployment. And we're sitting with young people who are either unemployable or just chronically unemployed. And so for some of them, this becomes more viable. It becomes less heartbreaking, less spirit breaking to go this route, to figure out how to make themselves as aesthetically pleasing as possible, to get into a relationship that will guarantee them some kind of ease. And it definitely is an indictment on our economic system, on our social political situation in the country, that this becomes viable to the extent where social media is booming with various coaches and various kinds of advice and tips and so on, people peddling this because there's such a huge demand for it. And so I just wanted to start by saying that. And then in terms of the history of this, so what I try to do is I begin with Professor Simidele Dosekun, who says that this suspicion of women who pursue relationships, or who are actually just women who consume, actually, let me correct myself. She says women who, African women, when they consume, when they are able to participate in the world of buying and being flashy, as other people tend to do, then it's easy to associate that with prostitution. It's easy to associate that with transactional sex more readily than it is women of different ethnicities. And she pinpoints that to the frustrations and the failings of the post-colony. And so, how I choose to interpret that statement, which is so very important, is to also understand how in a city like Johannesburg, for instance, how black women first enter the city, right? And we know because of British colonialism and how it has imprinted itself in other locales such as Nigeria and Kenya, we know that it was very important for only people performing labor to be included in the city. So men can be in or near the city to provide the labor they provide. They can be housed in compounds, etc., as we know with mining in South Africa. But then the women should stay home because when you bring women into the equation, you are risking a population boom among African people, which is not what you would want if you're trying to build like a white supremacist enclave and a city just for white people, right? And so black women begin to enter the city. South Africa, 1800s, they begin to enter through sex work and then later on through domestic work, later on through beer brewing and just other forms of illegal livelihoods, right? And so that's how black women first enter the city. So that kind of suspicion of what are black women doing in this space? Why are they here? It goes back to that, right? And so over time, I also trace it. I briefly touch on it that in the 1930s, there was this very big suspicion among, because now, you know, it's the 1930s. The ANC was founded in 1912. So we've got a class of mission educated, quote unquote, civilized, almost kind of middle class black people existing in South Africa. And so in the 1930s, there's this moral panic around modern girls and why these young women want to consume, why they want to dress like flappers, which was the fashion of the day, why it is that they want to wear lipstick, why it is that they want their affections to be courted with consumable goods like chocolate and perfume, etc. So it becomes an entire moral panic that I link to this ongoing conversation and concern around Black women's sexuality and agency. And why is it constantly a matter of concern? My response to that is, as Professor Simidelo Dosekun says about the failings and frustrations of the post-colony, we're in this post-colonial moment where I guess Black people are grappling with what it means to be like self-determining human beings after all of this colonial and white supremacist oppression. And when I bring it down to the intimate paradigm, you know, between these people who are meant to be like black women and black men and those relations, when I bring it down to that, I'm thinking that black men have suffered such a loss of control and domination in a way that patriarchy promised them they would always have, because obviously there's a way of being dehumanized by the political system of the day. And that loss then is channeled as a frustration and violence and just a dissatisfaction with how women are behaving and women's choices and wanting to, because you can't police your own humanity, wanting to police the humanity of women. And for me, that has constantly followed us. And that's why we get to a moment where we can talk about blessers and blessees and call women, black women, slay queens, and just have all of the kind of denigrating, you know, dehumanizing language for black women and what they do. Whereas, as you're saying, and as it is true, relationships and heterosexual pairings throughout history have been a way for women to gain social class mobility, you know? And yet, the fact that it only becomes so reductive, so myopic, that conversation is just reduced to ridicule and nonsense when we are talking about black women. I find that so mischievous, honestly.
Mischievous is such a sweet word to use. So this book is interested in the phenomenon of the soft life and choices that people make to pursue it, but it's very much interested in how people who make those choices are perceived, like the soft life as a cultural phenomenon, not just as people practice it, but as something that exists in the culture and is understood in a particular way. So you've mentioned in your answer now that Black women's sexuality tends to be subject to scrutiny in a way that other women's sexuality is not. Also, in the book, you mention a couple of directions or a couple of angles that that scrutiny takes, specifically in the context of the soft life or where finances play a role in romantic choices. The one is the association with sex work, which is not that same imputation isn't made to women of other races. And then the other is the medicalized discourse, focusing on HIV and AIDS and this the phenomenon of these relationships being a public health issue rather than an issue about romance or sex. Can you tell me how you challenge this existing framing with an alternative framing and centering women's, well, maybe let me, I was going to say centering women's agency, but perhaps it's best not to put words in your mouth. And you can tell me how you thought about challenging the frame with this book.
You know, that situation with the public health discourse, I found it so grating because right now, when you read literature around, academic literature around Black women's intimate lives, you can't read it without HIV being where we ultimately come to. A lot of the times, HIV is like the central focus of the book. And I've just found that so deeply unfair and so deeply dehumanizing for the fact that love, which is something that all human beings are constantly engaged in all the time, for this subsect of human beings cannot be discussed without illness, victimhood, and death constantly being brought to the fore. And so how I attempt to challenge it is to leave it out, right? And someone might want to challenge that decision, but for me, when I spoke to these women specifically, because they are the five women in this book are who I have built the entire narrative around, they are young women who obviously take care of themselves, who are cognizant of sexual and reproductive health matters, who love themselves and look after themselves. And so they do all the checks, they do everything they need to do. But I didn't think we needed to belabor that point. So my way of challenging it is to give you a full length book and to kind of just show, look at all the interesting things we can talk about here without having to bring it down to the matter of HIV and AIDS. Although, however, there is a chapter which I call Sex Work Gevaar, which I discuss the dangers and the issues of safety that the women are constantly have to deal with. And I hope that even though I don't speak about HIV and AIDS there, the implication is that there are matters of personal and public safety that we're always constantly having to navigate as women, regardless of who you are and regardless of what kind of relationship you're in. Because you could be a single woman and be in danger. You could be in love with a person who is perceived as poor and be in danger. And you can be in love with someone who is perceived as rich and still be in danger, because that's the reality of being a woman in South Africa.
Yeah, that was something that I found quite striking. So one of the women said something like, it doesn't matter who you're dating, they can always harm you, which I think is a hard won cynicism that many of us women have in South Africa because of the statistics. But I think it's important at this stage to talk about these women. We've talked about ideas so far, but like you say, you've built the narrative around the stories of these five women: Lihle, Jolie, Camille, Nomondwe, and Bongi. So can you tell me who these women are, what they're like, and then how you worked with them to build the story?
Okay, sure. So first we have Lihle. Lihle is an entrepreneur in the water and sanitation space. She's about 30 years old. She's the one who just believes that she doesn't want 50-50 in terms of splitting financial costs with men. She prefers to date men who are not South African because she feels that their treatment of women is better. And she, if you want to woo her, the way to her heart is to have dates with her in different countries because she really loves to travel.
Yeah.
And then we have Jolie. Jolie, I believe, is 28, if I'm not mistaken. She's an actuary. And she, in the book, for a large part of the book is dedicated to speaking about her relationship with Mangaliso. She was on the way to school one day when Mangaliso stopped his Maserati in the middle of the street and chased her down for her number. I think that's a fabulous story.
Yeah.
So I had to include it because who will that ever happen to, you know? So fabulous. And then Camilla is, I believe, 28. She is a junior publicist. She's a single mom to a little boy. And she is someone who has become more open to living the soft life over time. Because of patriarchy and being a Zulu woman, she always understood that, okay, I understand that men are supposed to provide according to the teachings of my cultural background, but wherever I look around, it's actually women who work the hardest and it's women who are keeping the lights on and it's women who keep this family going. So these are all these contradictory ideas that she had to negotiate over time, but now she's more open to living the soft life, but she's also very clear about the fact that she doesn't want to be with someone who is giving her the soft life through criminal means. And Lihle is also insistent on that fact as well. Nomonde is 32, I believe. She is a advertising executive in Cape Town. She's driven, ambitious, loves to travel. And she's actually in the book dating a man who's 4 years younger than her. And that is not what one would immediately think about when they think about the soft life. And so she's also just realized that he's 4 years younger than me. There's a lot that he actually can't do for me financially. I step in a lot of the time, but it's important for me to know that he has the potential to grow into the kind of partner that I would want financially. And so she's constantly saying, babe, please pay for this and please pay for that. And even when he doesn't have enough money or the money he sends doesn't cover it, she just thinks it's important to like train her man in that way. I found that quite fascinating as well. The last one is Bongi. Bongi is, if I'm not mistaken, in her 20s. I believe she might be 26 or 27. She is an entrepreneur in the fashion space as well. She studied like marketing and retail, and she's very passionate about her handbag store, but she also had to negotiate having her degree finally and yet being unable to find a job. And her one complaint was like, when I didn't have a degree, I could get all kinds of jobs. But now that I have one, it's almost as if I'm harder to employ because my degree means something. And I think that's something that a lot of young people in South Africa can resonate with. So among all five of them, they have their challenges because they're South African. They speak about so much of what we can all resonate with as people also living in this country. And that's why I loved speaking to them because they can provide that relatability for the reader.
Yeah, and it's such rich portraits that you create that they're layered and they're nuanced, and yeah, these are very interesting women. So how did you find them?
So this book emanates from my master's research that I conducted between 2016 and 2018, and then I finally submitted in 2019. And when the blesser blessee phenomenon came to the fore in about 2015, the reason why I continued to be obsessed with it is because this is the first time I saw a cultural phenomenon take shape before my very eyes. I was on Twitter, I was on Instagram, and I saw it happen in real time with people screenshotting things and being like, hey, this person is in Bali, this person is in Dubai, this person is in New York. How do they afford that? Oh, that person, but she's unemployed, and all the kind of, and how gossip and rumors and suspicion slowly turned into, by the time we got to like February, March 2016, it was like a conversation on radio. You had Current Affairs program, which I cannot remember the name of for the life of me, even though I quote it all the time. But that Current Affairs program had a feature with a blessee, and it was and once again, black women were public priority number one because of this thing that had taken place over the holidays. And I found it interesting as well that we had just come out of Fees Must Fall and the fallout, and like so many fallers speaking about the aftermath of what that was like for them, personally, the sacrifice, etc. And then just barely a few weeks and months later, you've got this boom of women being flown all over the world and just being wined and dined in all kinds of places. I found that super interesting. And so when I asked my supervisor if I could, research this, at first her response was, but I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's that compelling. But then it just took 3 months. By the time we got back to school, it was a big thing. And so my fixation with it is, again, I'm interested in how people are framing young black women and how that framing isn't extended to other people. And so I sent out a call on social media. This is a recruitment call for participants for my master's study. And the first time I did it, I was like, okay, so are you a blessee? If you are, please contact me. And I mean, nobody contacted me
Yeah, no one
because that
identifies with that term,
language.
right?
Because you're asking people to self-identify with something so negative and awful. And so when I redid it and I put out a small little questionnaire, like, are you between the ages of 18 and 27? Are you in a relationship with a partner who gives you money and gifts? Do you receive more than you give, etc., etc.? But when I just broke it down, then I think people were able to understand it, identify it with it, and then, decide to write in. But at the same time, I still didn't have all the people. I had about, I think I'd say 12 people who decided to be part of the research, but over time they all dropped out of the study because they realized what I was asking. They realized how intimate and deeply I wanted to get into their lives. And for some people, you can't share that much of yourself with a perfect stranger, which is understood. So I ended up just having three people for my MA. And then when it was time to turn the MA into this book, I was able to approach two other people that I kind of knew from the internet and said, if you don't mind, I hope you know my heart. I hope you know that my intentions are good and pure. And could you please trust me enough to work with me? So luckily, through that, I was able to complete the book.
One of the things that was kind of shocking to me in the book is the level of vitriol that these women, and by these women, I don't mean the five in the book specifically. I mean people who are perceived as pursuing the soft life. There's a podcast that you quote, two men talking to each other, where they say something along the lines of, like, if you can buy someone, i.e., like, get them to date you by paying for stuff for them, then you're within your rights to kill them. Like, that's what he implies. And it's kind of objectification taken to the extreme, but maybe even to its logical conclusion. Like, that is, if women are considered to have so little humanity, then they can be killed with impunity. I found it very upsetting to read. And it's not just that one guy who thinks that, the one guy on the one podcast. So you've touched on this in a couple of your other answers, but what do you make of the extremity of the vitriol? I mean, it's also like online spaces that we're talking about often, where these things do tend to be like the extremity is always turned up, like dialed all the way up, but the content of it is terrifying. So could you talk a bit more about that?
I find it completely heartbreaking, and I think that's what also motivates my desire to create work around this and to be like a voice of some kind of counter narrative, because it's completely normalized. The podcast that you speak of, sure, it that clip goes viral and people have all their opinions, and some people are outraged, but some people are in agreement. You get all of this reaction to it, and then that's it. Life moves on. But at the end of the day, this young woman who is successful, who is living the life she wants to live, she gets likened to a dog that could be killed on any day. And, all we have is conversation and we move on. But, for me, if we were a country that was serious about intimate partner violence, serious about gender-based violence, then those are the kinds of spaces we would be monitoring, because those kinds of people are so highly influential. They have so much reach in influencing the minds and the ideas of young men, And that's why in the book I also touch on my concern with movements around men's rights and red pill and the black manosphere and what that means for women, because feminism has come to the fore in the way that it has over the past decade. There are men who feel extremely victimized by the thought of women having choice and the thought of women having their full humanity. And that if, for instance, one of the principles around masculinity is that you should be able to access women in whatever way you choose, and yet feminism is telling women that, you have a full set of rights and your agency means that you don't have to just be with anyone. You could be a little bit more selective in how you partner with people. And perhaps men are in South Africa, as we all are, and they're realizing the socioeconomic hardships that they also have to navigate as men, what that means for their own masculinity. And perhaps then this kind of constant berating, this violating, this rejection of women who have agency is a way of clawing back whatever sense of power they feel they're losing, because that's what I think it is. And I could be wrong, but I think if you're going to have these amazing young women who you feel don't deserve to have the lifestyle they have, and they don't perhaps work nearly as hard as you do as a man, and they don't deserve this lifestyle, and you're so upset that they can just afford to be flown all over the world, and it hinges on their beauty, it hinges on their sexuality. And whereas you, as a heterosexual masculine man, your
beauty, your aesthetics, your sexuality cannot allow you to access that kind of lifestyle, that kind of leisure. Maybe it comes down to being so angry about that. I don't know, but it really does break my heart. And so it's important for me to try my best to be an intervening voice as much as I can, because it's completely abnormal. And the pipeline between the kinds of things that people spew out in public without consequence and that pipeline that then goes to the way women are violated again with very little consequence, it's completely abnormal and disturbing. And I think it's important that we kind of speak out against it as much as possible.
Yeah, I fully agree. I want to ask you about feminism. You're very open-ended in the way that you explore things and don't tend to make any strong statements about any of these women's choices. I thought it was interesting in your introduction. Chapter 5, Feminist Feelings, details the women's political beliefs and why they believe their desire for the soft life is not antithetical to feminism, although it ultimately is. So I guess my question there is why that's the case. And I'm hoping you'll touch on how viability as romantic partners for very rich men seems to be linked to a particular expression of femininity. And then I'm also hoping that you'll touch on choice feminism as a particular kind of feminism that we shouldn't be satisfied with.
Okay, so, you know, for me, I think it was important for this book to not be a feminist critique of these women and of the soft life. Because if it was going to be, then this book would end up in a very different place. And I feel like I wouldn't have had the space to afford them the grace that I wanted to afford them. And it was important for me, in terms of being a feminist, leading with the ethics of care in this context and situation required me to extend grace, because this is a grace that has been withheld from them in the public conversation for centuries, right? So for me, it was a corrective thing to not belabor the point of feminism. And then secondly, I think what was more productive and interesting for me was to understand how they each conceptualize feminism.
Right.
And of course, their own characterization of feminism is not the anti-capitalist, anti-neoliberal, anti-consumerist kind of conception that a lot of radical feminists would identify with, of course. But I thought it was also interesting to understand what they make of it and also how that has influenced their lives.
Because they each identify as a feminist, right?
They each identify as a feminist, yes. And so what I find interesting there is that it seems to me like, if I were to characterize it collectively, it's like feminism is this vehicle of self-realization and self-actualization and self-determination. And it brought them to a particular point in their lives, right? And then at the point where they recognize that socioeconomic precarity and femininity and masculinity in a patriarchal South Africa, when they realize those workings, that's at the point where they think that, okay, I think that I'm going to have to prioritize my desire for comfort, survival, and thriving in this economic dispensation over any kind of rad femme politics that I might want to have. I think that's where we get to. And I understand that, you know, choice feminism is something we should all be ultimately dissatisfied with. And I agree completely. And these are things that I, because as a feminist writing this text, it is something that I've had to grapple with, you know? And it actually was one thing that I was actually really scared about in putting this book out. Like, will the feminists accept this text? You know, will they be satisfied with it? Will it be seen as actually creating excuses and finding ways to be satisfied with the fact that this is taking us backwards? Because the notion of like a traditional femininity, and this is like having a huge resurgence on TikTok and social media, where women are like, actually, we want to be stay-at-home moms and actually we want to be housewives, you know? And that is, for me, again, the political economy of love. This is our response to our difficult socioeconomic circumstances. And I get it, you know, like it is completely heartbreaking to work so very hard and to have it actually count for so very little in this country. Whereas if you were in the global north somewhere, if you're in a Scandinavian country and you're working as hard as you have and you're diligent and you get your degree and you get the other one and the other one and now you've got a master's, you would be a highly sought after professional. You would be comfortable. You would be free to make whatever decisions you want to make. But unfortunately, we're in South Africa. It's a poor country, and women are having to be, as women have always been, creative in how they use their aesthetics, their sexuality, their femininity in order to get them to the next level in life. I think that is a more productive discussion. And what it does also is that instead of us being dissatisfied with the choices women are making, I'm hoping it makes us dissatisfied with our social political dispensation and the choices they are making and the ways in which they force us to have to abdicate very important parts of ourselves in order to try and actualize the human beings we want to become in the short space of mortal time that we have. I because there are women, I'm sure, who want to be deeply invested in their politics, be deeply invested in the work of community and care and collectivism. I know that, but is it realistic for many of them? You know, what happens to their own selves and lives when they give of themselves that much? Because a lot of the times they can't get much in return. These, for me, that's a more productive discussion, I think.
Totally. I was also thinking as I read this, like in a extremely unequal country, but also in an un like inequality that is, can I say unprecedented? I mean, I'll say it's really bad. Inequality globally is now really bad. And there is a kind of simplicity and rationality to, instead of trying to get from the block with very little wealth, work your way into the small, tiny block with all of the wealth, it makes perfect sense to rather try and attach oneself to someone who's already in that block. And I don't know, get some trickle-down economics from the unequal structure. Like, for many people, that's a much more viable strategy than, using work as a way to get there.
Yeah, and that's what it's always been, for women in the patriarchal system, where, for especially with something like in South Africa with ilobolo and bridewealth customs and so on, marriages have historically been used sometimes to forge peace between warring clans, or sometimes to start a new political dispensation by bringing two powerful people together. Sometimes it's a way to settle old debts, unfortunately, by, a woman going into a new family, etc. Marriages have been used creatively for all kinds of things by human beings. And this goes back to one of the things you said, like very early in the interview, when you said that people want love to be this thing that is so pure and so devoid of like economic considerations. Whereas in South Africa, especially as anthropologists have constantly documented, love did figure. It is a legacy of white supremacist anthropology for love to not be written about in the way it should have been. So that is something I'm very cognizant of. But it is also a fact that marriages were always tools to just negotiate society a little bit better. And I think women are just doing what women have always done.
One last question. So you are a PhD candidate now. What is your PhD research about? Is it following a similar trend?
It is following a similar trend. I want to spend the rest of my life theorizing around love and socioeconomics because I think those connections have been understudied for so long, and yet they are so rich and interesting. Because who we are when we are naked and when we are at our most vulnerable and when we are like sitting with the desires of our hearts, right? And how those desires lead us forward. I think that is such an interesting thing to consider because, for a lot of the time, who you are in those moments, sometimes you actually have to wake up and make choices that maybe go against that. But that is because the superstructure of the economy is constantly acting upon us, and sometimes we find various ways to push back. So I'm interested in young people. I'm interested in political corruption in the country, and the fact that it is such a very big fact, it is a daily fact of our lives. How is that influencing how young people are engaging in romance, relationships, love, and the aspirations they have for themselves as romantic persons engaging with each other? Those are the questions that I'm really interested in exploring, and hopefully, I will submit by August because I've been in my PhD program for a very long time now, so I'm just ready to be done.
I'm super interested in what you're going to do next. I also very much appreciate that this was turned into an accessible form that we can all read. It was just something that I feel like I needed to encounter. Thank you for your work, and thank you for speaking to me today.
Thank you so much, Vasti. Like it means the world to me that you took up the book, you engaged it. Some people think the book is only for Black women, but that isn't the case. So I appreciate you taking it, giving it a chance, and giving it your full attention and consideration. And I appreciate this conversation as well.
Thanks so much, Lebohang. The Soft Life is available at the Book Lounge or at your local independent bookstore. Today's recommendations are about books featuring anti-heroines, a theme that I'm personally very excited for. Anti-heroines are female characters who are unconventional, unlikable, who resist expectations, especially gendered expectations, who are criticized for wanting things for themselves, and often have an appreciation for the finer things in life. I asked Joy Watson to give us recommendations because she's the creator of one of the most memorable anti-heroines in recent South African literature. Her book, The Other Me, features Lolly, who is a character with a traumatic past and who will do practically anything to get what she wants. She's often egged on by her wicked alter ego, the other Lolly. Joy, apart from being a writer, is a feminist researcher and a columnist for the Daily Maverick. Here's our recommendations. Hello, Joy Watson.
Hello, Vasti.
Thank you so much for recommending books for us. I wanted you to come onto the podcast because, number one, I feel like you're a part of the community of readers. We did a live event together
Yay!
Last year. The other reason is because the theme today that we're recommending books around is anti-heroines. I don't actually like that word, so I might actually just say female anti-heroes throughout. And then I had to have you on because you're the author of one of the best female anti-heroes to come out of South
Yay,
African fiction
having
recently.
A moment where I'm doing a cartwheel when you say that.
I actually want to start by talking about your book and the ways in which Lolly in The Other Me is such a good anti-heroine. So she has a lot of strategies and plans and villainous schemes to get what she wants, often encouraged by her alter ego, the other Lolly, who encourages her to do these things. So could you tell our listeners a bit about that aspect of Lolly's character?
Sure. So I think, you know, I want to start by saying that writing Lolly was hugely liberating. It felt great to write onto a character the things that social conventions won't have us do. Mm. And so to be able to live that out on the page was quite fantastic. And so Lolly, you know, is somebody who is deeply damaged by her childhood, the socioeconomic circumstances, her upbringing, notions of trauma, and creates a sort of psychic numbing and way of coping whereby she creates an alter ego who is very real to her. She sees this as another version of herself, a stronger version, a version that's able to tackle the problems that she's unable to take on. And so the other Lolly really becomes this conduit for freedom and for lashing out and for kind of taking up space in the world, sometimes in very bad ways.
Yeah. So I also had that sense of reading Lolly that you're describing in writing, like that sense of freedom. I often get the sense of like deliciousness when I'm reading a female antihero. And I think something that feeds into that is Lolly's gift at pleasure. So she's someone who is into good wine. She's into good food. There's a lot of writing about that in the book, which I really enjoyed. There's a lot of sex in the book, and she's someone who prioritizes that. And those are things that I associate with a female anti-hero, someone who's willing to pursue their own desires and do things for their own sake and just because they want to.
Absolutely. She's very hedonistic. And I think for me, and I hope that this is not going to sound very convoluted, but I'm very interested in this. You know, when I think about my childhood, the ways of sort of romanticizing it and thinking about in very idyllic ways. But I'm also very aware of straddling both that and the ways in which it was limiting. And so my kind of primary identity marker is being a Black woman in this country, but I also associate specifically with being a colored woman. And sort of in, you know, the cultural associations of what little girls were meant to be back in the time when I was growing up are very sort of, the social norms are very much, they're not there in a way that is overt and sort of necessarily slapping in you in your face, but they definitely are these informal rules that govern how especially little girls are meant to behave and be and not seek out pleasure. And so one of the things that I find very interesting is what happens when we step into pleasure? What happens when we step into eroticism? What happens when we refuse to just see our bodies as sites of violence, but as sites of pleasure? And these are things, I think, particularly as Black women, that we kind of, you know, there's a consciousness around shutting that down and I guess in some ways being good Christian or Muslim girls and whatever the hell that might mean. And how do you dare to step outside of that?
It's so interesting because these are things that seem obviously good, right? Loving food, loving sex, a body as a site of pleasure. And it's kind of distressing how that is tied into an anti-heroine narrative. But it's obviously because women, and especially Black women, are judged in a way that men aren't for doing things. And that speaks very strongly to Lebohang's book, The Soft Life, where Black women are so vilified for doing something that other people do and don't receive any criticism for. So in relation to your book, I was thinking about how... So Lolly is obviously does some bad things. Her husband, Sadiq, is maybe more conventional in the bad things that he does, but he still also does bad things. But I've noticed that for some people, when they read that book, read Lolly as a villain, but read Sadiq as a nice man who's a victim of Lolly's Absolutely. Villainy. Have you picked that up in your readers as well?
Yes, and that was somewhat surprising because I thought it was very clear that Sadiq isn't. The whole point of the book is to play with the notion of moral ambiguity, that there are the fault lines unclear. That you have Lolly who does, you know, really bad things, but at the same time there's sort of this backstory to her. But Sadiq is equally bad. After a while, I think, you know, I began to realize, well, people aren't seeing him in his fault lines. And I mean, I guess that, sorry, this is a little bit diverging off track here, but I remember, for example, being younger and my cousin who was slightly older was about to get married. And my aunt was telling the story of coming shopping on the Grand Parade back in the day when they used to sell, have the markets there on a Saturday. And she said, wow, we went to look for the material for the dress. And my heart was beating because I didn't know what color she was going to ask for. And I sat mesmerized listening to the story. And she said to the woman, she said, I'm going to look at that material, please, the white. And my aunt says, so, you know, she's talking about her daughter. And she says, oh, I just had to breathe and thank God, because what if it was ivory? And the story really kind of sat with me. I mean, to the point by the time that I was ready to get married, because the whole thing was like you wore white only if you're a virgin. And if you're not, then it's hugely problematic and you're not being honest, etc. So by the time I got married, I wanted to kind of subvert all of that and throw it up. And I said to my mom, I want a black dress. I'm wearing black to my wedding. And she said to me, if you do that, I'm not going to come. She was like, was close to tears, and we had to then renegotiate how... I wore ivory, by the way.
Okay.
Everybody knew I had a child already. Everybody knew. But how, you know, those sort of social norms around women, no one freaking cares what color the groom wears, right? Yeah. No one cares.
No one asks the question.
No one's even asking wonders. What kind of material did he ask for at the bazaar?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's very much also about, yeah, there's all these expectations placed on women, and resisting them makes someone an anti-hero.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So can you give us your first book recommendation?
So, and it's one that I've read a long while ago, but it just stayed with me, Blessed Girl by Angela McCawa. Mm. And I mean, this book is seriously funny, but it's also sad because it's the story about Bonclair, who is a young woman, and she is also hedonistic. But you know, her hedonism is next level. She's champagne drinking, caviar eating, moving in the seriously top echelons, the social strata that's right up there and beyond. And when I talked with Angela about this book, she said that how it came about was that she was hanging out with young women who were in their agency claiming to have sugar daddies. Mm. So having sex with older men for as a monetary transaction. And what she was interested in doing was to write a book in a way that was not judgmental of this, that in the agency, this is what they're choosing. And it, there might well be ways in which it's problematic in terms of power imbalances. And Bonclair not only does that, but sort of vies for richer men. So she's quite ambitious in how she goes about getting what she wants. She also on the side sort of has her own business opportunities going, and they are they're like affirmative action tenders from the state to deliver things like construction services. And of course, these things don't quite exist. I mean, the extent of it is that Bontley walks around with a construction helmet, but like there's no real construction work going on. And so, you know, she's delightfully open and honest, but at the same time, tainted and corrupt and just beautiful in that way.
And allowed to be both, right?
And allowed to be both, yeah. Yes.
Angela McCaw is amazing. I haven't read The Blessed Girl, but I read Critical But Stable and loved that as well. Sounds like a very good companion piece to The Soft Life.
It is an amazing read and so worth, you know, just sitting in terms of how the story both is humorous, but ultimately it's a tragic story of the cost that comes with trying to find yourself as a young Black woman navigating your way through just the stresses and strains of life, especially in this country that is very messed up from the perspective of social inequity.
Mm. The first book I want to recommend, it's The Eye of the Beholder by Margie Orford. And I heard Angela and Margie in conversation recently on the Pencil Africa podcast. The Eye of the Beholder is about, so it's a crime novel, but not a procedural. And it's about child pornography is the crime in the book. And two of the characters, I think, could be are really good anti-heroes. One of them is the protagonist, Cora, who's an artist. And she, though she has a history of making very controversial art throughout her career, the last art project that she releases is the most controversial of them all. And that's because she portrays herself as a child. But at that point of girlhood when men start noticing you, and then instead of the looking being made the problem, it's internalized as shame.
Yes.
And then she captures that moment in these paintings she does of herself as a child. But then the crime of looking is then imputed to her.
Yes.
So she's vilified for exploring the subject matter in her art. So she's turned into a kind of anti-hero. Also because I think, as far as I remember, the people who do like the art kind of like it for freedom of speech reasons, you know, not because she's communicating an important thing or because they understand what she's saying. And then another character, Angel, who might be called Angel because she's kind of an avenging angel in the book. She's closed off, private, she's mysterious, and she has a mission of vengeance to try and find men who look in this way. And I think the title is so good because it's so insistent on pointing the finger in the right direction, which is the eye of the beholder, not the subject being looked at.
Margie Orford, when we talked about the book, said that she was working with John Berger's book called Ways of Seeing.
Mm.
So the idea that when we experience an act, particularly of violence, that there are no words in the world to encapsulate and give voice to that experience. There will always be this gap between the actual act and trying to express it. It is impossible. And the best next thing that we can do is an appropriation through words of bringing this act to life. And how, you know, she works with the concept of the male gaze. So, you know, in one way, similar to that sort of scopic colonial gaze, the kind of patriarchal gaze, the way the voyeuristic act of looking at women and how we internalize that gaze at times and look at ourselves through the same lens. And that book is beautiful in that way. And, you know, like one of the things that it got me thinking about is this gap between our perceived sense of self and who we really are at a much deeper level. And I think that this is what's great about books. The creative economy creates the space for the understanding of the parts of ourselves that we've not put out for others to see.
That's so interesting. How do you think that comes out in Margie's book?
So I think that in some ways, Cora is very protective of how a daughter sees her.
Mm.
The secrets that she holds in communicating who she is in her essence to her daughter. And so through the artwork also, you know, the daughter becomes, well, both from her mother and her artwork, knows that there's more than what meets the eye, and that there's the layers of narrative and story beyond that which she knows. And so this link also between seeing who we are, being who we are, holding secrets about who we are, become very interesting themes within the book.
Yeah. She spends a lot of time with her in her mom's studio growing up, Cora's daughter, and that's the best way that she can find to understand her mom is through her art, because what her mom keeps secret, she ends up revealing.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
So you know what? I honestly think that the book in some ways is a work of art.
Mm.
You know, it plays with art as a concept, but it is a work of art in its own right and what it does.
Mm. What's your next book, Joy?
The next book is, and I've read it, so you're now dealing with somebody whose memory, like, I gobble up books, right? And so I can't remember what I read 5 minutes ago. And this book I read a couple of years ago, but I thought it worth talking about, The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. And I mean, you know, it's so obvious why this book is special for those who have read it, but it's set in a sort of town in Louisiana, and is a story set in between the 1950s and 1980s about twins. The one girl, Desiree, is sort of forthright, kind of as a sense of who she is. Stella is a little bit more reserved and bookish. And essentially it's this, you know, traces their sort of dual stories of what happens as they sort of come into adulthood and get older. Stella, and this is dealt with in such a sensitive way in the book, decides to reinvent, because the thing about these twins is that they both are very fair-skinned. And Stella decides to reinvent herself, to run away and reinvent herself as white. Mm. And this was very interesting to me because it is something that happened in this country, particularly amongst colored people. It happened in my family, where because of socioeconomic circumstances, some people decided to get themselves reclassified. And you know, like those bizarre tests that they used to have, the pencil test and so on, that this was a real thing. And often those people were then ostracized by the communities from which they came because they were seen as sellouts. However, you know, they were also able to then live a different kind of life that came with this reclassification. And I remember meeting this cousin socially, who I didn't know was my cousin. We had the same surname. And she sort of asked a question around, might we be related? And I was like, no way, there's a blonde girl with greenish eyes. And long story short, it turns out that she was my cousin.
Mm.
And then I went home for Sunday lunch and really proudly said to my dad, I tacked on this so-and-so, and his face, the anger, the pain, the hurt. And he got up, and it wasn't directed at me, but I internalized it as being directed at me at the time. Mm. He yelled and he said, never talk about them ever again. And it transpired that he was made when this brother of his had been reclassified. When he had visited, he had to go through a back entrance to visit, and he took the decision to never have contact again. So these things are real, and, yeah, and the beauty of this book is that it deals with the subject in such a sensitive way. And yeah, I enjoyed that it wasn't just the usual trope of somebody who does the, like, you can't, there's a link between that and childhood trauma that Stella experiences.
Totally. Yeah, it's totally sympathetically told. Also want to mention, this is also a theme in your book, The Other Me.
True. This is a theme. It is a theme. Oh my gosh, I hadn't seen this. Yes, but my book also deals with somebody who is fair enough to be reclassified as white and is adopted by a white family. And that whole kind of identity crisis of what this means when you are something that you're not.
Yeah. Also, I read The Vanishing Half years ago, and I want to ask you about the ending, but I can't do that because that's a spoiler. So I'll just say that I second your recommendation. I think it's such a richly told story. Like, it's almost kind of old school in like how rich it is and the scope of it and the intergenerational aspect and the family drama. It's wonderful to read.
And it's also, I don't want to give away too much, but there's a beautiful, so eloquently sketched strong story in the book that just, you know, I mean, like you feel all the feels, right?
Yeah. My next book is, I know you've read this one as well, is An Unusual Grief by Yolanda Omotosho. And I have to be a little bit creative about putting it into the theme, but I have to recommend this book because it's so good. One of the best books, I think, to
come
out last year.
Can I just say, I'm really proud that you one day can write in that way, but I'm also so jealous and wonder when I grow up I want to write like that.
No, but Joy, you're also writing like that.
But that's next level. She is just God on earth.
Yeah,
wow.
It's an incredible book. So this is a story of Mojisola, who is a mother to an adult daughter who has taken her own life, and they were also estranged in the last years of Mojisola, of Yinka's life, and then Mojisola goes to Cape Town to try and figure out what happened, like what led up to that decision that Yinka made. And in doing so, like, I mean, obviously devastating loss is at the center of the book, but somehow in that exploration, she kind of steps into Yinka's shoes, and in that finds a little bit of freedom. So she sort of retraces Yinka's steps, gets to know the people that she knew, and in that almost has access to the way a different generation of women live. And also specifically, she starts experimenting with kink, which is this very unexpected turn for the book to take. But then she's this very like closed off, remote, unknowable woman. And then suddenly she just has this gap opens up for her and this exploration ensues. And I think she's a great anti-hero because the book is kind of asking, what do you do when you are adhering to people's expectations of you? And what do you do when you allow yourself to step out of those expectations that people have of you? And I think she's kind of an unlikely character for this because she's older, and because her life until that point is quite as people would have expected. But yeah, wonderful character, wonderful book. I love the sexiness of it, and I love the weightiness that grief is also given in the same story.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the book is such a resource actually for people going through grief, because it really captures the essence of that sense of sitting in loss and being haunted by those who have left. And I loved the that sort of side story of a woman who's older, kind of stepping into sexual freedom. And also then, you know, the analogy of how loss can be liberating, how loss can open up your freedom. And, you know, so the sort of sexual escapades and the things that she gets up to. What it got me thinking about is the tropes that we have, particularly I think in this country, around what motherhood is and the associations with nurturing and protecting, which of course, you know, it is in some way, but how I guess in some ways we can kind of trace this back to the liberation movement also, like the virtue associated of women in the struggle as being mothers, you know, that there is very much that language and that discourse in kind of ANC literature of women and motherhood and their stance in defiance of the apartheid system. But also, you know, problematic notions like, which were useful at one point in time, and now we have to question their usefulness. You strike a woman, you strike a rock. We also need to be thinking that we might be at a point we have to rethink about that. You're not striking rock, you are striking flesh and bones that can be hurt. So I loved this kind of subversion of the notion of motherhood and the trajectory of a story where we think like a mother's going to grieve her daughter who's just passed and is going to act itself out in particular ways. And it's not that at all. It's this unleashing, this stepping into self. I mean, I remember being at a book festival where in my book, there's a scene of a threesome and the person facilitating the panel asking me, so have you ever done that? Which should not have happened there. Yeah. But the first thing I thought is, my daughter's in the audience. And at the same time, you know, I like to find ways of suggesting without doing this in ways that are traumatic to my daughter. I'm sexual. I'm a sexual being. I love, sex is good. It's great. We must have it. We must experiment with things. You must do shit. And like, hello, older people are doing it too. And they might be doing it better than you because they've had a lot more years of experience to be playing around.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because Mojisola, because she's so like zipped up kind of for the first
half of
her
life. Like a church
person. But that makes her hard to get to know by her own daughter. You know, she's kind of like closed off even to her own daughter. That's not a criticism at all. It's just like a reveals how costly it is.
Absolutely. And I think that we kind of straddle those parts of our identity. I know that, oh gosh, and how do I say this now in ways that aren't problematic? I know that, so I, you know, am the first in my family to have had a university education, and I'm very aware kind of like how that's come with access to better jobs and resources and kind of a middle-class lifestyle. And I'm also very aware that, like, in certain spaces, I am in particular ways. And when I go back to places where I come from, I am different. Mm. You know, that whole kind of outsider-insider thing. And even though you're an insider, you're still an outsider because you don't quite now straddle the class stuff anymore. And how, you know, I, for example, don't go to church at all.
Mm.
I'm not religious, but put me back where I came from. I'm like the loudest singer of hymns, you know, and that's interesting that ways of fitting in and ways of rejecting fitting in and the very diverse aspects of our identity, who we are, is so layered, so complex, and that, you know, attempts by society to straitjacket just are often futile and stupid.
Totally, and which is why we get such great anti-heroines in literature. Joy, it's always a pleasure talking about books with you. Likewise. Thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Absolute pleasure and happy reading.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Thank you to Lebohang and Joy for making the time to record with me. This season of Reader's Community was brought to you by me, Fasti Karlitz, and our team. Andrew Burnett is our brilliant senior producer and editor. Kelly Eve Quipman is our assistant producer and researcher. And Simone Rademeyer helped with the editing on this. A heartfelt thanks to every author and reader that came into studio or recorded with me online. This season was funded by a grant from the National Arts Council and the Presidential Employment Stimulus Program, which is really the reason why we were able to do the season at all. Thank you to the Book Lounge for sharing the season in their newsletter and their website, and for helping in lots of other ways too. All the episodes that we recorded in person were recorded at Cape Town Office, a co-working space with a gorgeous studio that you definitely should check out. And finally, thank you to you, the listeners. Thanks for spending your time and attention listening to these conversations. Thanks for sharing the podcast, for coming to workshops and live events, and for being part of a reader's community. Until next time, keep reading.